Good afternoon, and welcome to week 26. Oh boy, sometimes it feels like one and sometimes it feels like 50, you know? We are in the 15th parak, the 15th chapter. I'll ask people if they can please silence their various electronic devices and so on. Silence, vibrate, off, whatever you like. But we are still in the beginning of round two. I think we're on the third week in the of starting round two of Eliphaz's opening speech. I'm not going to recap the entire book at this point, but the speech that Eliphaz gives begins, as we saw, with a rejection of Eov's words in chapters 12 to 14. Not a rejection of their substance as much as a rejection of the fact that he's speaking at all. Job, your words betray your wickedness. The one substantive point that Eliphaz makes is, he said, "Tafer yirah." You are nullifying or canceling reverence, awe of God. And we gave two different explanations. Either, Job, with your words against God and divine justice, you will cause people not to revere God. Or alternatively, by saying that everything is fate, you are devaluing religion, you are devaluing Torah, you're saying that there's no point in addressing God. And then he said also, you think yourself wiser than us, you think yourself older than us, and you think yourself justified in your quarrel with God. And that was really the first 16 verses of chapter 15. And then he shifted gears to talk about how the wicked suffer. And this was something that in Eliphaz's first speech, back in chapter 4, he had already addressed in a small way, saying that the wicked suffer. But now he spends more time on it. He begins by establishing the pedigree of his words, saying that I've seen it myself. And he said, the wicked suffer psychologically. They're always afraid. They're always concerned about when their downfall is going to arrive. They're afraid of being attacked out of the blue. They're afraid in the dark. They're afraid in the light. Doesn't make a difference. Which may have been also a charge against Job, because Job has described himself as living with this fear. And maybe what he's saying, not so subtly, is what you are experiencing is what wicked people experience, because they are constantly afraid. And that brings us to the point where we left off last week. Perek Tedvav, chapter 15. Pasuk Chavei, sentence 25. We read through it quickly last week, but I'm going to just go back to it because we need the running start. It's on page 1641. 1641, if you're using the art scroll Tanakh. Sorry? 837 in the Koran. Sentence 25, Pasuk Chavei. Eliphaz switches gears. He stops talking about how the wicked are always afraid, and he begins speaking about how they have no hope. And he begins by describing what they've done wrong. He says, Kinata el kel yado ve'el shaka yis gabar. Because the wicked person raises up his hand against God, he acts as though he is mighty when he runs at God. Yarutze lav bitzavar, he runs at God with his neck outstretched, the image of arrogance and the image of fearlessness. Ba'aviga be'maginav, with the thickness of his shield, which could be a reference to his armor. It could also be a reference to his body itself, different approaches in the commentators. And then Pasuk Chav Zayin, sentence 27, ki chisafanav bechelbo. He is covered in fat, and the image here is of somebody who is wealthy and enjoys life, and he has everything, and he uses it to just enrich himself. Vayas pima ale chasel. The description of how he is covered in this. And we said more about that last week. But that brings us to our first new verse, sentence 28, in which he describes how the wicked have no future. Vayishkon arim nichados, batim lo yashavu lamo, asher hisat du legalim. Very interesting structure in this sentence. Normally, Eliphaz sticks to the structure that we've seen on all the speakers of sort of couplets. Each sentence has two halves, and the second half generally is either a repetition of what the previous half said, or is a building upon what the previous half of the sentence said. Here, he uses a triplet, which we've seen before. It's not unique, but it stands out. And what he does here is very clever. You notice the term that he uses, first of all, literal translation, sorry, that the wicked person dwells in arim nichadot. Nichad is a term for something that has been ruined. V'hichadativ, I will destroy them. He dwells in ruined cities, in houses which are no longer settled, which are destined to be ruins. Galim, like a gal, a pile of stones. Yeah. So it also refers to a wave. It's from the same source. Gal, when you're dealing with a stone, will be a pile of stones. Gal with water is a pile of water, a wave. It's the same origin. Yeah. Yeah. Heaps of water, heaps of material. But yeah, since we're talking houses here, we're dealing with stone. But look at what he did here. We've talked about before how Eliphaz is the most poetic of the three. Three different terms in this sentence for the place in which one dwells. Arim, batim, galim. Right? Cities, houses, ruins. That's one piece of it. Second, the sort of descent. The city, but it's still called a city, that's in ruins, and then the house in which no one is going to live, and then finally it's all going to be just a pile of stones. I like heap of stones. That's helpful. But it's a sort of descent that is seen for the wicked. There's no hope. It's all destined for destruction. Why is he dwelling, though, in a city that's an abandoned city? Why is the city abandoned? Why would he choose to live in an abandoned city? Put it that way.
Pariah.
What do you mean?
Pariah.
Sorry, he's a pariah. So he has to be away from the population. So even Ezra says something similar. He says that the wicked person has to hide out in uninhabited areas because he's afraid for his safety. Let me go hide. Yeah. Right. People will abandon him. They're not going to be by his side, so therefore that's the only place he can be. Could be.
He also just, he doesn't see it that way. Isn't that Eliphaz's criticism? He's saying, you see it as this old palace, but really it's a broken down ruin.
Interesting. So the idea would be that he doesn't necessarily perceive that he's living in a ruin. Excellent idea as well. It could just be the outside observer sees it as a ruin. Could be.
Also, when you're really feeling like Jonah's,
yeah.
You don't want, people tire you, you don't want people around as much, you need positive. Like people are very sick and a lot of pain, don't want a lot of people visiting or coming or talking to them. It's too much effort, it's too much work, and it takes all your kishka, so to speak, to
right.
talk or whatever.
Right.
Although here it says that people believe that desolate places were inhabited by evil spirits.
Well. That's nice. I wouldn't read that in here because it would say so explicitly if that was the concern. But I want to go back to your first point, the point about people wanting to be isolated. I think that's true in general, but I think that it doesn't fit in Job in the sense that Job is perpetually speaking about how he wishes he had people by his side, just not these three. He wants people who will be supportive in the way that he believes he deserves to be supported, as we're going to see, and that will come up more in chapter 16. But I want to note a couple of things here within this section. There's a lot to say on this, but there are a couple of things that I think are worth noting. First of all, flip back to chapter 5, please, sentences 3 to 7. This was Eliphaz's first speech, and I've already shown you how certain elements within his second speech hark back to themes he first voiced in the first one. Well, here's a very clear reference. Chapter 5, sentences 3 to 7. If you're using the Stone Tanakh, you want the bottom of page 1625. So look at what he commented on there. He said, Ani ra'isi avil mashrish ve'ekov naveu pis'om. He says, I saw a wicked person who looked like he was setting down roots, and I cursed his dwelling suddenly. Yirchaku banav miyesha, his children will be far from salvation. V'idaku bashar ve'in matzil, they will be crushed at the gate, there will be no one to save them. And so on. He continues with the idea, especially in sentences 6 to 7, that which the wicked person builds will not endure. He already said it in his first speech, and now you could read this, and this is the way Rashi reads it. He's building on that idea and saying he builds up. The city is not a ruin when the wicked person goes to live there. He builds up the cities, but they collapse. That which he builds is not able to endure. And that's a second explanation for what's going on here. Third possibility is, Mitzudat David suggests, he builds up ruins in his own name. No, it's not a ruin. He builds up this. He finds a ruin, you know, buy low, sell high. Takes advantage of a market inefficiency. He finds a ruin, he builds it up, but then it collapses because that's the fate of the wicked. That which they build does not endure. In the end, it ends up, as Eliphaz predicted in the first speech, that's Eliphaz's theme. Whether you like or not the statement that which the wicked builds will not endure, we're getting there. But that's Eliphaz's sentiment without a doubt. That's what he's expressing. Yes, Rita.
You know, this has been bothering me since the beginning of the book.
Yeah.
Does God also look at how Job's friends are talking to him? Like, do they think that maybe they're being judged too? As to how, because, you know, people are supposed to have passion on. Since the beginning of the book, I've been wondering about this.
Well,
they don't even think that, do they?
But hearing that you've been thinking this about this since the beginning of the book, I have good news and bad news. And you already know what I'm going to say, right? The answer is yes, this becomes a factor in the book, and the answer is we are not getting into it this year. It's going to be next year. But yes, God is going to actually take them to task directly. They clearly believe, though, that God is watching. They think that they're doing God's work. They believe, like Eliphaz in the beginning of this speech, that Job is speaking evil things that are destructive and they have to right the wrongs. Or we saw, I think it was Sofar who began his speech by saying, I have to speak up because otherwise people are going to think you're right. They actually believe that not only is their point of view correct, but that they have an obligation to teach others, if not Job, because he won't listen, at least the anonymous listeners. Yeah, sorry. But that's one note. A second note that I find really interesting here, if you remember back to chapter 14, Job used the image of a tree to contrast people and plants, right? He said the tree regrows. People don't come back, right? We talked about whether Job believes in the resuscitation of the dead, ultimately, Tchiyat HaMeitim or not. But Job used the image of the tree to say, you cut down a tree, something eventually is going to grow out of that spot where the tree was. You cut down a person, and they don't return. So Eliphaz is going to borrow that image here. Right now, he's on buildings. But in another couple of verses, he's going to use the image of the tree and say the wicked person is the tree that has no hope of regrowth, like you see with these buildings. Debbie.
Yeah, I have a probably too big a theme. But he's talking a lot about how a wicked person feels. Most wicked people do not feel that what they achieve is wicked. Therefore, why would you feel bad? I mean, we can all personalize this notion of a wicked person. We all know some wicked act, wicked person.
Mm-hmm.
And generally speaking, I'm okay. This is not right. Mm-hmm. I'm an accountant. I stole from my client. It's okay. He was really rich.
Right.
The only time they get upset.
So why would you feel badly? Yeah, why would you feel badly if you're a wicked person if you don't?
Right. It's an excellent point. From their perspective, the wicked person knows he's done something wrong. Because otherwise, why would he be nervous and expect trouble and so on?
They're describing those characteristics to a person, saying that that's how he would feel because he's wicked. But that's not generally, I think, it's not the case.
So, but what I'm suggesting here is that they believe that Job knows deep down that he is wicked, and that even if he doesn't know in what way he has been wicked, he should accept that if God is hitting him, there must be something wrong with him.
This is getting so Catholic to me. This is getting so...
No, not about It's not an original sin concept. It's a you did it when you were X number of years old concept. The answer is Job.
No matter how hard you try, you still are sinning.
No, not so much. For all I know, they're saying you probably didn't try at all. You know, Job is alleging that he's done the best he could. Right, but Eliphaz, remember, we always have to keep in mind the central themes of each of the speakers in this book. Eliphaz's theme is, if you are suffering, you must have done something wrong. Contrast that with Bildad, who says, if you're suffering, it means God is planning something good for you, it's just not here yet. Or Tzofar, which is, if you're suffering, it must be you didn't do enough good. Not that you were bad, but you had potential to be better. You know, they have these different perspectives, and they're nuances that we've spent the whole year, you know, discussing. But from Eliphaz's perspective, Job, even if you think that everything you've done is justified and good and right, you should be learning a lesson from the fact that you're suffering. That should be what tips you off that something in there is wrong. Now, they will get to specifics.
All sufferers are being punished.
That's Eliphaz's point of view. Yes. One second. Shane has been waiting. Yeah.
I think there's a distinction to be made here between conscience and fear of punishment. When you were saying earlier that a wicked person is about body die. Wicked, a body die is something wrong, who cares?
It's not really wrong.
But even a person who thinks like that may still be conscious of the fact that the world considers what they did wrong and will take action if they discover it. So that is the sort of the worm that's eating at the foundations of the building for him. And I think whereas conscience is the internal realization, the actual moral understanding of what you did is wrong. And I think one of the things that is happening here, and I'm not sure which of the three would be the one to espouse the view, is that if Eov doesn't realize that these punishments, these events are punishments, then he just doesn't understand how the whole system works. He has neither conscience nor fear of punishment, and he's just hopeless.
Well, right, that's true. In other words, once you say, as Job says, and remember we have two layers, two different approaches to Job, either he is saying that God doesn't reward and punish, he left that to the stars, or he is saying that God does punish, but his punishment is inappropriate for what's happening. Either way, whichever way I read what he's saying, he's speaking an entirely different language from someone who's talking about a correspondence between what you experience and what you've done. And I like your distinction in terms of you know, the conscience element of it. I do think that there are people who don't even have that kind of disturbance. Like, they genuinely believe that what they've done is right. And whether in terms of a revelation type of right and wrong, or in terms of a logical right and wrong. In other words, there will be a person who will say, you know, take it from a Jewish perspective, even though Job may not be Jewish, but from a Jewish perspective, there may be a person who says, yes, I know the Torah says, don't eat X, but I am justified because such and such, and they will have no qualms of conscience, and this is what they do. Or, in terms of things that are logically right and wrong, right, the sikhli, you may have a person who knows perfectly well that it's considered inappropriate to steal from other people, but that person once did X to me, and I am getting back my own. Or they didn't have a right to it either, or whatever it is, and no qualm of conscience whatsoever. Not because they're bad people, because they're generally convinced that they're right. Susan. And then I'm going to want to go further, because there's so much to see here. Oh, it was either the approach that God isn't running the show, he has outsourced it, or the approach that God's punishment is inappropriate. So he said before, why are you following my every step? Don't you have better things to do? You know, you're so great, I'm so small, why are you even looking at me, God?
The thing, though, that I don't agree with is when people say they don't know they're doing bad. I don't agree with that, because you may say, like, if I didn't get caught, you know, they knew it was bad, but as long as they didn't get caught, they got away with it. So it's okay. But somewhere, on some level, if a person has
any, like, let's say if you don't believe in the Torah, so okay, I don't believe in the Torah, so I'm not going to keep kosher. But if I know there are certain moral values, and if I steal, I know that's morally wrong. I may do it, I may try and get away with it because he's rich, I can justify it, but the reason I have to justify it is because I know it's wrong, or I wouldn't be justifying it. I wouldn't say to you, well, it's okay to not pay taxes because...
I'm going to leave this open-ended. I have a different perspective on it. Maybe I'm more evil than you, but I think that not everybody thinks that way.
I think more people than you think. It isn't just the sociopath.
Even better.
I think the
maybe there are more sociopaths than you think.
The older I get, the more I see people doing things that are morally so culpable and not feeling that way. Not feeling good.
Okay, I'm going to go further here. We've described the wicked person as living in ruins, places that are destined to become heaps. Sentence 29. Lo yeshar v'lo yakum chelo. He will not become wealthy. His chayil, his wealth, will not endure. The term chayil is always translated in Eshet Chayil as valor, which is nice. But chayil isn't really that narrow a term. It can refer to wealth, to strength, to might. So it will not endure. V'lo yitel la'aretz min lam. The word min lam is a very tough word. I'm curious to hear, actually, how the different translations render it. I see here in the art scroll that they render it as their aspirations will not touch the ground. Min lam is the tough word. It's not a normal word in Hebrew. They render it as aspirations here. How does the Koran view it, Joyce?
He shall not be rich, neither shall his substance continue.
Yeah.
Neither shall their produce blend to the earth.
So they take produce. They take min lam as produce. They do produce. Produce. Okay. Aspirations are produce. So what is this exactly? According to Ibn Ezra, what it's saying is their intact wealth. And minlam is that which of theirs had been complete. That which had been complete of theirs. So their intact wealth will not endure. Yitela aretz, he takes as to extend going forward, like noteh shamayim is to extend the heavens, or noteh in general would be to extend something forth. Mitzudat David renders it differently. Rabbi David Altshuler, he says, actually it's their punishment. Minlam is that which is supposed to affect them, to punish them, and it's saying it will not miss them hitting the ground, it's going to come for them. It's a difficult read in terms of the sentence structure here. The point, however you read that clause, and as I said at the beginning of the year, we're not going to sit here and dissect every clause because then we'll never get through the book. But the point is, he's saying that which they have is not going to last. And then? Okay, that's fine. I'm sorry, I don't want to get bogged down. And then in Pasuk Lamed, in sentence 30, we get the tree image. Lo yasur mini choshech. He is never getting out of the darkness. Yonakto tiabesh shalhaves. His yonake, his root, that which nurses, that which drinks, will be dried up and consumed by the fire. Viyasur, notice the yasur, beginning of the sentence, end of the sentence. It's part of his plays on words. Viyasur beruach piv. It will be knocked over by the wind of his mouth. And there's a lot going on here also. I just want to pick up on a couple of points. First of all, he will not get out of the darkness. Refer back to sentence 22 where he talked about the wicked person's fear of darkness. That's a major image for Eliphaz, is the idea of the wicked person living in the dark. Number two, from a poetic standpoint, he's used the word yasur twice in the same sentence with different meanings. Lo yasur, in the first part, was he will not escape. And then yasur, at the end of the sentence, is to be knocked over. He will not yasur to escape, he will yasur to be knocked over. Same word in Hebrew with two different meanings. It's just part of Eliphaz's poetry. But the major point that I wanted to note is the last clause of the sentence. V'asur beruach piv, he will be knocked over by the wind of his mouth. Whose mouth is that?
It's capital H here.
Capital H in the Art Scroll.
Yeah.
And in the JBS. In the wind of God's mouth. That's a random appearance of God. Meaning Eliphaz has not, until now, talked really about God striking the wicked person. He's almost acted as though it's a natural occurrence. You do bad things, you will live in fear, and in the end, that which you build will collapse. Suddenly here, he puts in the idea, and this is indeed Rashi's idea, that Mikra introduces it as well, that Hashem is going to blow him over. It's not only a natural thing, you know, some kind of karma-esque type of fate, but rather, this is God intervening to destroy the wicked person with the breath of his mouth. That's one way to read it. The other way to read it would be, there's a completely different way to read it, and that is it's not about breath at all. It's saying that the new growth is going to be knocked over. Piv, his pet, is his new growth. And that's going to be knocked over. But the first way is the way that most read it, as you saw in your translations, that he's saying it's not just natural that they will collapse, but that Hashem is going to make sure they collapse.
Can you also read it as he's knocked over by his own breath, the wicked person, as it is boasting, which is what Eliphaz is criticizing Eliel, right?
So right.
So high-handed with your words.
Right.
So it's the same words that are going to knock you down again.
So I wanted to read it that way when I first read it, because I find the reading that it's about Hashem so out of place in the rest of Eliphaz's speech. The problem that I have with it is, number one, that others don't take it that way, and I like to find some basis in it. But also, he's not really talking about boasting at this stage. He's just talking about the wicked person as being frightened and living in ruins and being isolated and so forth. I don't think he's describing a boasting person at this stage. So I find that a little difficult, but I'm open to the idea, theoretically. So take a look now at sentence 31. Sentence 31. Al Yamein, here's another play on words. Al Yamein Bashav Nita Kishav Tiyet Murato. He will not believe in Shav. What is Shav usually? Emptiness, vanity, a waste, nothing, right? He will not believe, and the way I'm going to read it is the way Mitzudat David reads it. He will not believe. The one who wanders in nothing, kishav tiyet murato, that what he receives in return is going to be emptiness. He lives in nothingness, and yet he doesn't believe that that's what he's going to get for it. It's a remarkable sentence. I really love the way he does it in the Hebrew. If you take a look at source number one, I brought you Mitzudat David to see it directly. He says, Hato'el alechet b'derech shav, one who wanders following an empty path, lo haya ma'amin asher tmurato tiyeh shav. He doesn't believe that his reward will be empty. Rotzalomar shegmulo yek mif'alav, meaning that which his payback is going to be according to what he's done. Whether he doesn't believe it because he thinks he's been good, or whether he doesn't believe it because he thinks he won't get caught, whatever it is, he says, in the end, he's going to get nothing, even though he never expected that was actually what was going to befall him. And so, in Pasuk Lamed Bet, sentence 32, I'm racing a little bit here, because I want to make sure to get to this discussion about whether they really believe all this. Below Yomo Timale, before his time comes, Timale, it will be full. V'chipaso lo ra'anana, we're continuing the tree image. His kippah, which is a reference to a branch, not to a yarmulke, something that arches. His kippah lo ra'anana will not be fresh. Contrast that with Tehillim, right, about the righteous, tishenim v'ra'ananim yehu, they will be refreshed. He will not be refreshed. His time is up early. Yachmos kagefen bisro v'yashlech kazayit nitzaso. This is another great image. The Yachmos, Hamas, those who were here last year when we spent the entire year on the Medrash on Parshas Noach, right? Hamas was violence and theft, right? Yachmos kagefen bisro. He violently casts down his unripe fruit. Boser is unripe fruit. like a grapevine. He's like a grapevine dropping the grapes before they're ready. V'yashlech kazayis nitzaso, and he throws down his flower like the olive. And I've seen it written, although I don't know from experience, that olive flowers drop early in the season. But I don't actually know that. The fruits that he promised, the flower that you saw there, it's all gone. Everything he has is gone early. Ki adas chanef galmud ve'esh achla ohalei shochad. Because the group of wicked people, and the word chanef, we've said before, it's used quite a bit in Iyov, refers to a flatterer normally, but in Job in general, it's just used in terms of wickedness. So the group of wicked people are galmud. Galmud means they don't have any children. And fire consumes the tent of the wicked, and shochad is a reference to bribery, but it doesn't have to be here. And once again, he's saying their tent is going to be consumed. They're not producing something that will endure. And finally, the last sentence, Eliphaz knows how to end on a high note. Haro amal vialod aven ubitnam tachin mirma. They conceive amal, which is worthless struggle throughout the book. We've seen that word over and over. V'alod aven, and they produce either emptiness or worse, wickedness. U'bitnam tachin mirma, their belly only prepares a trick. There is promise, and it is not fulfilled. So, on that note, Eliphaz is warning him. Now, again, we began this chapter by asking, what is the point? Why does Eliphaz emphasize the suffering of the wicked? And it's not just Eliphaz. Bildad and Sofar are going to do the same exact thing. Why are they going to place so much stock in convincing Job that wicked people suffer? We gave three explanations, right? The first explanation that we gave was that it's a warning to Job. Pursue what you're doing, and you're going to get zapped. As though he hasn't, right? That's number one. Number two, second approach, is that it's a statement that there is divine justice, and therefore you're wrong when you claim that there isn't any. Wicked people are punished, and yes, good people will be rewarded too. Although they're putting all their money on the wicked. And then a third possibility, that it's a statement to him that the wicked are punished, and therefore you should understand that the righteous will be rewarded too. And therefore, don't worry, you're going to be rewarded for the good things that you did. It just hasn't come yet, but it's going to happen. So that's what Eliphaz has emphasized. After spending his first 15 or so verses on telling Job how wrong he is, that's his central point. But now I want to get to this question, which we've been asking all year long. Do they really believe this? Have they not lived? Have they not looked outside? Have they not experienced it? That there are wicked people who do just fine. So one approach, assuming that you don't say that, no, they believe everything's good. They've never seen it. You know, I could say that, but I'm not going to spend time on the idea that they all, you know, lived in a bubble. One approach is, no, they don't actually believe it. Their point is not to say that this is the way the world works. Their point is simply to charge Eov, saying Eov is going to suffer because he's wicked. And that's really all they're concerned about. They're not concerned about how well their comments hold up in terms of the global experience. Their point is really about Job. That's one way that you can read this. And some read it that way. But I think there are two other reads that hold more water. And one is from Carol Newsom. And you can see it here in source number 2. I brought you excerpts of what took her like 10 or 12 pages. And if you read hers, you will get a much more full understanding of it, but I wasn't going to retype, you know, 10 or 12 pages. So I tried to get what I believe conveys the basic idea. If you take a look, we last week, or the week before, we read the opening part, which I didn't reproduce here in the interest of getting everything to fit on a page. But her opening paragraph in this section, she says, when I teach this every year to my students, inevitably, I ask them what they believe about this. Is this real? And they all say it's nonsense and it's not true, and they can quote specific examples that show that. And then she says, I think that their argument argument of, I've seen specific examples, their argument is not a valid argument against what Eliphaz is doing here. When they say, it can't be true, it doesn't suit our experience, that's not a legitimate defeat of Eliphaz's point. It doesn't counter Eliphaz's point, and it's for reasons that she's now about to spell out. She says, yet if such statements were intended as universal, exceptionless claims, okay, if this was meant as a description of the way the world works 100% of the time, only a deluded fool could believe them. All the underlines are my own. Only a deluded fool could believe them. And whatever the friends may be, they are not fools. They're also not friends, but that's a side note. Not in the way we conceive of it. But they're not fools. That's not why they're presented to us. And that goes back to a point that we made a while back. You can't read this book as Job is the good guy, the friends are the bad guys, and we're going to spend the entire book laughing at the friends for what they're saying. Because then you have to ask, what is this doing in Tanakh? Do we really need a 42-chapter book in Tanakh in which you have three people saying things that we're going to reject out of hand for, you know, the bulk of the book? Their arguments must have something to teach us. We don't view them as fools.
Isn't their very theme sort of showing that? They think this is consolation to them. On some level, they do. So when they're saying this, I think in a formal argument, I think what most people would say, you know, from a point of view is, I may not have seen that, but it's an intellectual concept that we know we've been given. So, yeah, on an intellectual level, I'm sure it works out, you know? God's not an idiot, he doesn't miss the plot. And that's basically what Eo seems to do with them. He seems to say, he backs off, he's like, I'm a little extreme at the beginning, right? But then when he goes into, no, I believe in the important point, his point is being microanalyzed. Okay?
So he
rejects that. He says himself later, the wicked aren't my concern. I'm not mad because that evil guy got $1 million. Right? You're totally mistaken. Of course he gets crushed, whatever, blah, blah. That's not my concern. And then they move on to the righteous guy. So I think they do see it as him, that must be what's bothering him. Right? He must be looking at these evil people and saying, look, they're flourishing.
But why would they try to comfort him with an intellectual concept?
Well, I think it's because all of these things are emet, but there are layers of emet, and none of them are wrong, but Eo is most right. So I think he says that too, that your arguments are simplistic and stupid, and I don't even need to answer a lot of the questions.
Right, but I think that you run the risk of reading the book then in the context of what the reader is meant to learn and not in terms of how the story holds together. In other words, saying that what they're saying is true, just not the entirety of truth, is good if I'm reading this book solely for what I'm supposed to glean from it, that I'm supposed to read Eliphaz and draw certain things from it and not others. But the story has to hold together. And what are they trying to say? I think take a look at what Newsom has to say, because I think there's a lot to be said for this. She says, what is at stake between Job and the friends is making evident the nature of the world, which each attempts to communicate through vivid evocations. This work of disclosure is the work of metaphor, the seeing as that produces redescriptions of reality. Thus, the dialogue between the friends and Job becomes a struggle over metaphors and a conflict over stories. What she's trying to say is that what they are trying to convey is not, you're going to see this come true 100% of the time, but rather a message about, and maybe this is where you're going with the intellectual idea, I'm not sure, but the idea that this is the way the world works, as we will show in the metaphors that we bring, the trees and the houses and so on. And she explains more as she goes through. This claim about reality, meaning the claim that Eliphaz is making, that there is justice, however unobvious it may appear to modern readers, was one of the most widespread and fundamental beliefs in the ancient Near East, attested to in many literary forms, though given its most articulate expression in wisdom literature. Restated in conceptual terms, meaning not in terms of all the metaphors and everything else, but stating the concept. This belief is that good and evil have a different relation to reality. And she'll explain, and then I'll explain her explanation. The resilient, enduring quality of good derives from its participation in the structures of creation itself. Whereas evil, no matter how powerful and vital it appears, is actually fragile and subject to disintegration because it has no root in that order of creation. She gives an example, the first song. What she's trying to say is perhaps best captured by the classic idea from the Talmud about the words emet and sheker, and I really should have brought it on the sheet to make it even more clear. If you have the Hebrew for it, it'll work. Otherwise, it will be a little more difficult to explain. But the words emet and sheker mean truth and falsehood. Emet, truth, is composed of aleph, mem, tav. And if you imagine those letters the way they're written in a Torah, aleph has two legs to stand on, mem has a solid base, and tav has two legs to stand on. Emet stands. Sheker, meaning falsehood, the shin in the raglaim bidyuk. Sheker, the shin in a Torah, comes to a point at the bottom. It doesn't have a flat base the way they taught you in grade school. It comes to a point at the bottom. The kuf has one leg that's a short leg and then one leg that's a long leg so that it's going to topple over. And the resh has one leg. Sheker, falsehood, collapses. That's cute. But what it's expressing is a deep idea. The world is built on truth. By definition, the world is a true world. It is created by God, whose seal is truth. Sheker, falsehood, is the opposite. It is decay and destruction. It has no place in this world, and it will not endure. It's a value statement. It's not a statement of, I have observed this world and I've seen that good people thrive and bad people suffer. It's, the world must be so. This is the way God made it. That good people, or goodness I should say, is going to thrive and that evil is going to collapse. It has to be so. So keep on reading now because I know what you're thinking. Just wait. Debbie. One cannot convince another of the truth of this perception by means of argument. You can't argue someone into believing this. For the issue is fundamentally one of perception itself. Rather, as Raphael Demos says, one can only evoke a world. You create an image and say, this represents the world that I see. A vivid pattern of a whole. The persuasive power of an iconic narrative does not derive from a simple empiricism, right? Where I logically deduce and I see a case and I draw a conclusion from that case. No, no, no. Although it cannot be wholly disconfirmed by experience and remain plausible, the story remains surprisingly resilient in the face of a mixture of conforming and non-conforming experience. In other words, people who don't believe this, people who believe that wickedness thrives and nice guys finish last, even when they see a nice guy finish first or a wicked person suffer, they'll say that doesn't represent the world, that's not the way the world works, and something bad is going to happen to the good guy and something good is going to happen to the bad guy. And someone who looks at the world and says, my understanding of the way this world works is that goodness endures and wickedness suffers, even if I see something in particular that doesn't fit, I'll say, Kasha, that has to be discussed. You know, there must be some answer for that particular anomaly. That doesn't represent the world because it doesn't fit my understanding of the world as I see it. And she gives a great example here. This is a great example. An example from contemporary American culture may illustrate. Apologies to Canadians. Consider popular business literature, in which the story is told over and over of the individual who turns a creative idea into a flourishing business. This is the iconic narrative of entrepreneurial capitalism. Everyone knows that the large majority of new businesses fail, yet the story does not lose its power. I once had a friend who was in the restaurant supply business, and he said 80% of his time was spent going into restaurants that had failed, taking out the equipment, refurbishing it, and then selling it to people who were starting up a new restaurant. That's the way it works. That story is seen as expressing the nature and essence of an entrepreneurial society with all the static cleared away. Ignore the fact that they all failed. You can start a business and succeed and become, you know, the king of an empire. Even though you'll see all sorts of examples in which it's not true. You inherently believe this is the way the world can work. I just have to work hard enough, plan well enough, invest, and then this will happen. Finally, she says, an anecdote about the success of the wicked cannot explain the reality of this world of values, which is experienced as such every day. Every day, the friends, Eliphaz in particular, because he's the one under discussion here, but the others are going to say it as well. Every day, Eliphaz wakes up in the morning with the conviction that good is rewarded and bad is punished. And he goes about his day seeing everything with that comprehension. And if something happens that doesn't fit, he says, that requires some investigation. But it doesn't change the way he thinks about the way the world works. I could give you another example, actually. Newsom wouldn't have thought of this, but the Middle East. Right? People who believe that Israel is wonderful and that everybody around them are evil, it doesn't matter what you see, we'll never think otherwise. And people who believe that Israel is a horrible villain, that transplanted European Jews who took over somebody else's land, you could show them Israelis treating Palestinian kids in their hospital side by side, and you can show them warnings, and you can show them all the different humane methods and everything else, and that they're giving Oz electricity. It won't matter. Their view of the way the world works is Israel bad, everybody else victim. And you're never going to convince them otherwise. That doesn't mean you shouldn't try, but you're never going to convince them otherwise. This is their view of the way the world works. And that's what's going on here, is Eliphaz's view is, this is the way the world functions. I stopped her short. Such things may happen that wicked people thrive, but they are perceived as anomalies, lacking explanatory power. That doesn't explain the way the world works. But the story of the wicked overtaken by calamity, like the story of the restoration of the good person, rings true because it is consonant with the foundational values of the society. Rita.
What happened in the Holocaust? Look at all the good people who died there.
So I'm going to invoke my Holocaust rule, which is I can't explain it. I have never been able to and will never be able to. I heard Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, Alav HaShalom, say the following sentence. I think I remember it verbatim, although it was, 25, 26 years ago. He said, people approach the Holocaust from one of two perspectives. Either they approach it from a secular perspective and they end up spouting heresy, or they approach it from a religious perspective and they end up spouting stupidity. That's almost word for word what he said, because it made that kind of an impression. Once you go there, the discussion becomes absolutely without merit. You can't do anything with it. But the point here is what she's trying to express is this is what is driving Eliphaz, Bildad, so far, as they approach Job. For all the suffering that Job is experiencing, for all of the misery and all of the loss of his children and the loss of everything that he had and his suffering with his boils and everything else, their answer is going to be, that's not the way the universe works, Job. Wicked people are the ones who suffer. If you're suffering this way, you must have done something wrong. Goodness is rewarded. And if you've been good, then you'll get reward. That's their take. That's a second approach. I want to float a third idea, although I think Newsom is right, but I want to float a third idea because I really like it also. Paul, sorry?
I was just going to say, maybe this is all really an education of the three, not of Job, and an education for those outside the book who believe what they believe.
Right, so as I said to Yishai before, I think that there is certainly something that the reader is supposed to take away from this. And I think you can take it away from all the perspectives that are in the book. There are things that we're supposed to learn. However, I am a believer in the idea we've said in other weeks that the friends are really part of Job's test to see how he's going to respond to people who talk to him in this way and to these ideas. I think this is, and we've seen how, with everything they say, they drive him further and further. Next chapter, in chapter 16, we're going to see him take another step that he hasn't taken yet. And it's a very harsh one. Like, they are part of the test, just as his wife and her one sentence in the entire book was part of his test.
Complex texts work on different levels.
Yep, very true. Take a look at the third piece. The third piece is my own. When my older daughter became bat mitzvah, so we put together a bencher, a birkon, and this was a paragraph that I included as a comment on a verse that appears towards the end of Birkat HaMazon. It's a verse from Psalms. It goes, Nar hayiti gam zakanti v'lo ra'iti tzadik ne'ezav v'zar'o mevakesh lachem. I was a youth, I have now aged, and I have never seen a righteous person abandoned and his children seeking bread. And you look at it and say, what are you talking about? Seriously? You've never seen that? I mean, of all people to say that, King David, who was abandoned so many times in his lifetime, how can he possibly make such an assertion? It's ludicrous on the face of it. So there are various explanations. One explanation that is popular, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks has quoted it, although it originates, I believe, with Moses Feuerstein. If you remember his story, he was the owner of Malden Mills in Massachusetts. The story goes back, I think, about 20 years already. There was a massive fire on December 23rd, 24th, and the factory was destroyed. And he told his non-Jewish workers that he would keep them on the payroll until it could be rebuilt. So it was this big miracle for them at their holiday time that they were going to be out of job and they were able to survive. You know, it was a big deal. He was a very, very good man. I heard him speak a couple of times. Once? Maybe once. Yeah. Sort of. But the point anyway is that he made a comment on this verse that Lo ra'iti doesn't mean I didn't see it. It's I didn't see it and fail to act. I didn't just watch when somebody was abandoned. I actually did something. And I think that's a very important lesson in its own right.
He was literally that guy, though.
Sorry? He was literally the guy. He's
the son of the tzaddik, literally looking for bread, right?
Well, and that, right.
I think, isn't it more likely that what he's saying is what you think is abandoned is abandoned?
Maybe. Maybe, but I want to show you what I have in number three before we finish today, because I think I think this is an important idea. I think it is absolutely pshat in Tehillim. I think it is exactly what King David was doing. Whether it's what Eliphaz is doing is where I'm not sure, but I think it's an important idea. The Book of Tehillim, Psalms, is neither a work of history nor a collection of prophecies. Rather, Tehillim is an archive of prayers. Tehillim is King David's monument to faith, a record of his relationship with his Creator throughout the epic struggles of the most embattled figure in all of Jewish scripture. From family strife to national upheaval to international conflict, from punishment and rejection and distance from God to cycles of sin and repentance and love and longing for the divine, from public humiliation to the vision of a triumphant temple built, King David expressed in words the extremes of human emotion he experienced through the numerous religious apices and nadirs of his 70 years of life. He's got all the ups and downs you could possibly imagine and then some. Through that lens, the words, I have never seen a righteous person abandoned, may be more prayer than assertion. The king who had known dire circumstances, poverty, flight, life as a fugitive before King Shaul in the land of his foes, the son of Shalom who attempted to kill him in pursuit of his throne, another son, Adoniah, who staged a feast while his father lay on his deathbed in an attempt to claim the throne for himself. He pledged fealty to God, saying, despite all of the suffering I have seen and experienced, I have faith that you would never truly abandon the righteous. We invoke this prayer at the close of our Birkat HaMazon, our blessing after eating, as part of our own assertion of faith. The man who trusts in God is blessed, for I believe God will not abandon a righteous person or his descendants. God will give strength to his nation. He will send them shalom. It's King David's prayer and ours as well. In other words, Tehillim, Psalms, is not meant to be read as a historical statement. It's meant to be read as tefillah, as prayer. That's the way we use it. And so when a person says, I have never seen, he's saying, God, I hope I will never see somebody abandoned. I trust you to actually do right. So I believe that that's the basic way to understand that verse in Psalms. And I think that perhaps that's what Eliphaz is trying to get across to Job. That this is what we are supposed to long for and associate with God. Instead of reacting to your circumstances with anger and rejecting and saying there is no justice and only evil, and if God is punishing me, I don't deserve it, and so on and so forth. Instead of that response of rejection, what you should be responding with is, God, I believe that you are good, and I believe that you are going to help me, and that you're going to make things right. That's the education he's trying to provide and to model for Job, maybe. So we have three answers to the question of, do they really believe this? One possibility is they're just using it as a charge against Job. Wicked people suffer, you're suffering, do the math. Second possibility is that this is their view of how the world works, and particular examples aren't going to dissuade them from that. They'll just view those as anomalies that require explanation. But the fundamental rules, this is a Newtonian law of thermodynamics, good things are rewarded, bad things are punished, and that's the way the world is, Job, no matter what you can cite to the contrary. Or third, this is the healthy reaction that they want Job to have to his suffering. This is what we believe that you, Job, ought to develop for yourself. So, to sum up Eliphaz has become harsher since his first speech. Perhaps in reaction to Job's harshness against God. Or perhaps because Job has alleged, he said in the previous chapter, that he's really the righteous and pious one, and that all of them are fools who are just trying to bribe God, and that they're wrong. Whatever is driving him, he becomes harsher, and he says, "Job, you have chutzpah. You are the wicked one, and yet you call us wicked, and you justify yourself. The wicked suffer psychologically, and the wicked have no hope for the future. And there truly is justice coming in this world against the wicked and on behalf of the righteous." That's Eliphaz in a nutshell. And so what we'll do, God willing, next time is start Job's response in chapter 16, chapter 17, and see what he has to say in reaction. Thank you.